So this is the last lecture of this class. We are still talking about democracy, and today specifically about what Angela Davis calls abolition democracy, a phrase that she gets from W.E.B. Du Bois. And more broadly, probably we are still talking about freedom and equality. There's also this connection, something worth remembering, that very different governmental structures and economic systems with which those structures are coupled use the term democracy and claim that they are the real democracy, the way that obviously the United States holds itself up as a model of democracy for the world and even militarily enforces the idea that this democracy ought to be exported to other people. It's so great. And yet, of course, we can look at this democracy and say, well, really, it doesn't look very democratic at all. In fact, as Angela Davis says, it's actually racist capitalist imperialism masquerading as democracy. American capitalist representative, whatever kind of government we've got here, calls itself democracy, but other systems use the term democracy as well. Socialism claims to be more democratic than capitalism. And this seems to be the heart of Angela Davis' position on the matter, that the granting of legal and political equality and freedom is insufficient when it is in a context where racism continues and is structured institutionally, and in a situation where that freedom and equality are not supposed to extend to the economic domain. A lot of what she has to say and what fits under the heading of abolition is about the need to establish equality and freedom also on an economic level. And she comes pretty close to saying, I'm just advocating socialism here. I think that socialism is the only thing that would really complete the process of the abolition of slavery. And here she's just saying the same thing that W.E.B. Du Bois said. But then, of course, there are even more radical people than socialists who might call themselves communists or anarchists who feel that freedom and equality and rich version of democracy are still not even possible in a state socialist system. So long as you have police, so long as you have a centered system which is premised on a docile, numbered, named, individuated, working population. So long as that is the case, whether we have socialism or not, we still will not have, the invisible committee think, democracy, freedom, or equality. There's also a difference between the way that Davis approaches her analysis, her critique, and then her recommendations, and the way that the invisible committee do, in that I think Angela Davis is operating at a very large scale. She wants to think about the nation state and the relationships of nation states, whereas the invisible committee think that we need to focus on the here and now, ourselves, our everyday life practices, our immediate connections with our situations, our physical circumstances, the events that are happening around us, and the people that we love and that we hate. And if we really want freedom and equality in a lived way, if we really want democracy in a lived way, our emphasis really has to be on this singular local experience. So you could read it like the Invisible Committee goes even beyond Davis in suggesting that we can't have any government and have democracy, freedom, and equality. But you could also say, well, maybe their focus is just different. What Davis is trying to elucidate is the conditions of a real democracy, which she thinks would be the same thing as an international socialist project or network. And then the Invisible Committee, who are not interested in thinking about these large-scale institutions so much as they are interested in thinking about the immediate quality of life and character of life, and especially the question, are we numbed to everything around us? Are we individuated and believing that we are separate, floating, isolated entities in an alienated world? Or are we tuned in? Are we really experiencing? Are we really feeling the events and the people who are around us? How are we living? And is that living a mode of freedom? Does it involve radical equality, which they suggest exists primarily, originally, in friendship? And are we engaged in a regular practice of discussion and decision-making? Now, they don't really emphasize the terms democracy, equality, and freedom, but I do think in a lot of ways that's what they're talking about. So this is what we're getting into. Let's start with Angela Davis, but actually, let's remember for 1 minute Thucydides. I offered Thucydides in this class because I think that there's this very educational contradiction going on in Thucydides' account of the behavior of the Athenians during the Peloponnesian War. The Athenians prided themselves on their democracy, on their being a society that recognized the freedom and equality of everyone. This is what Pericles said in his famous speech that's been repeated now for 2,400 years. We're still reading this speech, which still expresses the at least nominal values of Western society. Western society is tolerant. It recognizes the dignity of everyone and so on. But then if you look at how the Athenians actually behaved, not even to non-Greek people, where they were even harsher, but to the Melians, other Greek people who were neutral in the war between Athens and Sparta, but Athens was demanding that they submit to the Athenian Empire. In that case, there's no discourse about tolerance. There's no discourse about democracy and equality and freedom. There is only a discourse about force. Now, the reason to bring up that contradiction, you know, what the Athenians say and do it in a limited way in their polis, is directly opposite what they do outside their polis. As Davis says, the limits of solidarity seem to be drawn at the walls of the city. We still have this problem. Okay, so to go over to Angela Davis, she's writing in 2005. The book is Abolition Democracy. And she begins by considering the debate about torture that went on in the United States around Guantanamo and extraordinary rendition and Abu Ghraib. And she says, you know, even the response to the scandal of Abu Ghraib, the circulation of these pictures, had itself a racist dimension. And the response actually facilitated the continuation of the torture because it continued this racist dimension. So what's racist here? Well, what's racist is the inability to sympathize with or to conceive and imagine as specific, regular, but also suffering individuals, the Iraqi people, or in general, those subjected to American military force and the individuals at Abu Ghraib. Davis points out, you know, we never saw pictures of those people from their regular life such that we could understand that they were teachers or artists or engineers or, you know, regular useful people with families. We didn't see pictures of who they really were in their real life. We only saw those degrading pictures of naked bodies piled in a pyramid wearing hoods. That is a horrible and ugly set of images and set of facts about American practice. But even the way that it was criticized, the way that liberals got all worked up about it, did not fix the racist problem. The racist problem is that we are educated to view these others as less than human. We are educated not to feel together with them, to separate what happens inside the nation state and who is in the nation state from who is outside it. And even, especially at this time and right up till the present, we are also encouraged to sympathize with, to recognize as human, the citizens of the United States, but not the illegals. This distinction, which is a racist distinction, operates internally, but especially externally. The United States has the same problem, has the same structure as Athens. Perhaps Western society has this problem, where it will humanize in a certain way those who are within the walls of the nation, but it dehumanizes everybody outside the walls. Now, the point is, we are supposedly a democratic society, but we cannot be a democratic society, says this socialist thinker, if we do not extend our notion of the freedom, equality, dignity of everyone beyond the walls of the city, beyond the walls of the nation. It's a very strange thing that we generally don't do this. It's a very strange thing that the Athenians didn't do this. Well, unless you start to recognize that, well, Athens had a democratic process in a limited way for a limited group of people. But more than being a democracy, it was the center of an empire. Similarly, the United States might have some vestiges of democratic practice. Davis complains that we seem to have reduced the notion of democracy to voting. So, yeah, we vote. But democracy rests upon the recognition of the freedom and equality and dignity of everybody. So if we are incapable of recognizing those things beyond the walls, perhaps we are not fundamentally a democracy, but in fact, we are actually an empire. And Davis says she prefers to use the term imperialism because imperialism refers to a process, a way of doing things, a constant military expansionism, a domination by the use of force, but also a psychology, an internal psychology and ethic, a psychology which includes contempt, disregard, dehumanization, profound arrogance, and an ethic, you know, an idea about like who we are and what is required of us, which includes impunity, asymmetry, and lawlessness. We are not actually a democracy. We use the language of democracy, but the language of democracy veils what's really going on, which could be technically called racist capitalist imperialism. One other thing to note before going on, one of Angela Davis' fundamental concerns in the past 20 years of her writing, and as she has increasingly identified with the abolition movement, has been on our capacity to imagine. So when we look at the way that we are unable to think of the victims of American imperialism, the victims of American torture, as individuals, that is a limitation of our imagination. We really are stuck. It's not that they're not individuals. It's not that they're not suffering. It's not that they're not equal. It's not that they don't deserve to be free. It's that we just can't conceive any of those things. It's not about reality. It's about cognition. But this cognition, this inability to do those things, that is a part of the racism of the country. It's only a cognitive limitation, but that cognitive limitation is a real thing in the world, and it fuels a real military, imperial, racist, capitalist thing in the world. This inability to imagine extends all over the place, right? We can't imagine a society without police. We can't imagine a society without prisons. We can't even imagine a society where people are economically secure, where we have dependable housing, food, clothing, education, the basics that would correspond to our dignity and our freedom and our equality. These are the things that Davis thinks need to exist, need to be brought into being if we are to become a democracy. As things exist now, the problem with the term American democracy or the identification of Americans with democracy is that we know it's only voting deep. There's no other democratic thing. There's no real valuation of freedom and equality, and it's really clear when you see the pictures from Abu Ghraib. We don't care about suffering and individuals and all that, not really. And or if we do, we know that the government doesn't. And so this causes a degradation of our ability to imagine democracy, to imagine a full and robust democracy where freedom and equality are really centered, are really facilitated, and real institutions, real organization of the society takes place to match this democracy. We can't think about democracy because our imagination has been limited by what they say is democracy. And so at best, we end up cynical or ironic. So what is the solution as far as she's concerned? The solution is to extend beyond the walls, is to start looking not just at ourselves, but at the rest of the world, and not just at the citizens and the relatively secure middle class in the United States, but at the non-citizens and at the lower classes. We need to extend freedom and freedom and equality to both of these groups of people, and that implies an end to American imperialism. We cannot conscience those wars, and we cannot call ourselves a democracy so long as we do conscience the wars. We got to end our racism. And then internally, the problem, she suggests, is that we have freedom and equality. We have democracy in the thinnest possible way. We have nominal politically equal rights. We are protected under the law, even racially, through the civil rights movement and civil rights amendments. But that protection under the law actually ends up serving problematic racist purposes. It can be used to continue the overpopulation of the prisons by black and brown bodies because now you're not allowed to consider race or consider the really divergent, different backgrounds of different economic classes when it comes to considering their so-called crimes. The point is, if you still have a racist structure, if you still have an unequal structure, and you still have a society which is inertially racist and keeps certain racialized classes down at the bottom, and then you erase any knowledge or reference to that racial structure in law, then law can still operate to reinforce the inequalities that already exist. To put it more simply, you can't just have political and legal freedom and equality. You must also have economic freedom and equality. Real democracy could not stop with the political and the legal level. It must extend to the economic. And so she gives examples, and these are the things that she means by abolition, right? Like, we have trouble conceiving a society without prison, without the death penalty. But that doesn't mean they're not possible. It just means that there is an objective limitation of our thinking, and that objective limitation of our thinking objectively operates in sustaining the society of the prison and the police and the incarceration and shooting of black and brown bodies. We have to go beyond the political and the legal to include the economic, and the abolition of these continuing institutionally racist institutions, the undermining of those can happen through the establishment of programs and institutions which address economic inequality, which really objectively change the condition of the lowest classes, the working classes, and especially the racialized working classes. And notice also, she says, this is not just about identity politics. This isn't just like saying all the black folks have to get together because the black folks are divided. They're some of them old, some of them young, some of them rich, some of them poor, some of them men, some of them women, some of them gay, some of them straight. You know, it's not just about organization around an identity. It is about the establishment of institutions which objectively operate to alleviate the conditions which lead to things called crime. That's abolition democracy. She gets it from Du Bois. So Du Bois writes this famous, beautiful book, Black Reconstruction in America, in which he says, look, the United States abolished slavery or thinks that it did, but it actually didn't complete the job. And therefore, black people are still imprisoned. They're still enslaved. They're still an underclass. They're still racialized. They're still not free. How did they not finish the job? Well, because, yeah, they did away with chattel slavery, but they did nothing to change the economic condition of this population that had been enslaved. Nor did they do anything to change the institutions of punishment which bear disproportionately upon black and then brown bodies, particularly the death penalty. The death penalty is a legacy of slavery. And she points out, most of the world doesn't have the death penalty, right? We're at the head of the pack. We've got all kinds of people lined up to be executed. What is it about this so-called democracy that makes it the most violent perpetrator of state violence, maybe in the world? Well, it's that we are continuing slavery. The death penalty existed and was centered and operated from the period of slavery through the period of Jim Crow, always differentially. It didn't operate the same on white people and on black people. All kinds of crimes for which white people would get off lightly, black people would be put to death for. So the death penalty itself is a racist institution, and that disproportionality continues to the present. And then she says, so we should get rid of it. It's not civilized. But the solution that a lot of people think of, like, okay, we'll just keep people in prison forever, that's not valid either. Du Bois says, we got to get rid of the death penalty, and we got to get rid of prisons. Because prisons are just another form of enslavement. And here you can go watch the documentary 13th to get Angela Davis' particular read on the 13th Amendment, which disallows slavery except for incarcerated people. So in the immediate aftermath of Reconstruction, after a decade or so of an attempt or a kind of half attempt to reconstruct Southern society so that African Americans could live in, you know, a real economically secure life, that's given up. The Northern capitalists team up with the Southern plantation owners again, and prisons and chain gangs take the place of enslaved labor. You still have African bodies, still in chains, still with no rights. It's just that the language has changed. It's not slavery anymore, it's prison. Prison is still a continuation of the structuration of this country by slavery. So what needs to happen is they need to be done away with. But this is not some utopian idea that there's no such thing as crime or violence. Instead, what abolition wants to do is to substitute institutions that will help people out of poverty, that will help people get jobs, that will guarantee housing, that will guarantee a good and solid education, these sorts of things. She says, you can have a democracy in that case only. Democracy is a society where freedom and equality are recognized and supported not only politically and legally, but also economically. We need to break down our nationalism and become internationalist, and we need to break down our racist institutions and become democratic internally. These are her recommendations. Now, I'll say less about the Invisible Committee, except to say, well, I'll start by saying, look, what Angela Davis is a communist, but in the state socialist sense, right? It basically finishes up by saying, what we need is socialist institutions. And I agree with her that that would be a lot better than racist capitalist imperialism, and certainly a lot closer to democracy. a better form of democracy, and certainly a realer recognition of freedom and equality than the faux consumer market freedoms that we have, you know, the reduction of democracy to the right to vote. But the thing that she doesn't really talk about here, at least, is the abolition of the police. And there's a perspective, an anarchist perspective, which also calls itself communist, but in a kind of pushier way. From their perspective, actually, if you abolish the police, you also have to abolish the state. The police are the backbone of the state. The police are what makes the state possible. So on their view, freedom and equality and democracy, although they don't really emphasize these terms, but I think the content is the same. Freedom and equality and democracy require that we become entirely ungovernable, that we reject government altogether. And that starts with rejecting the police and policing. Now, Davis doesn't weigh in on this, but I still picture Davis imagining a kind of nation state or an internationalist assembly of nation states, still probably centered bureaucratic mechanisms. And from the Invisible Committee's perspective, it would be hard to imagine even that state socialist society without police. What do the police fundamentally do? They make a population into a population. That is, they turn a group of people into passive beings, individuated beings, docile beings, and ultimately working beings, such that they can be both exploited by capitalists and organized by, pacified by the government. The police are the continual reassertion of an order. They're the continually reasserted precondition of a state order. Now, they go even further and they talk about the state of exception. This is coming from like Giorgio Agamben and Carl Schmitt, who understand sovereignty as resting upon the state of exception. This is at odds with another legalistic tradition which suggests that the legitimacy of governments comes from the consent of the governed. Carl Schmitt and Agamben, they're like, no, if you look at how government really works, it's not about like its legality. It's not that it just rests on some kind of legal contract. Rather, the sovereign is the one who can determine when the law doesn't apply. You can tell who the sovereign is because the sovereign will call in the troops anytime things get out of line, right? If you start to become ungovernable, all of a sudden this democracy looks a whole lot like an autocracy. This so-called land of freedom and free speech starts to look like a police state, because it is. And all over the world there are police states, and we would do better without them. The police are the everyday manifestation of the state of exception. The police are above the law. The fact that the police walk around with guns on their belt and shoot people every damn day shows that the law isn't what's real. You know, the law is an aspect of what's real. Legal life and the moralities that go along with it, the respect and the freedoms and equalities that go along with law are every day contradicted by the very presence of the police with those guns and those batons on their belts, that mace and those handcuffs. Every one of those things is a crime. It's a tool for a crime. But those crimes are the functions of the police. So the suggestion is that we should have a society, we should become ungovernable and not have a society, but have different communities. They've got a very specific read on society. Like society is always, is a political construction. It's an agglomeration of individuals, but this individuation separating us out as if we were not really connected to one another, as if we were separable, as if we were atomizable. This is an economic function. This is part of setting us up as being governable. And going to socialism doesn't get us past the society of governable individuals. We have to do something more to get to real freedom and equality and democracy, to get to community instead of society. Okay, so communism, they say, they're talking about individual, well, not individual, local, group, singular practices. Communism is something that we want, but it's also something that we practice, and it comes from experience. Why is it that we want something called communism? Why is it that we want to share? Why is it that we want to be ungoverned? Why is it that we want the police to disappear? Because we already have an experience of something much more powerful than anything these societies, definitely the racist, capitalist, imperialist society, but also even the state socialist society, can offer us. We have much more intensive experiences, most of us at some point, than these societies not only offer us, but then they even allow. These are the experiences of friendship and of love. We really have an experience of going beyond ourselves, of being a part of something that is right here, right now, but extending beyond my body, my identity, or my mind. This is what love is like. This is what friendship is like. A whole lot rests on friendship for them. And notice, like I said before, I think the difference between them and Davis is really about, it's about their focus. They are looking at everyday life, everyday experience. We really have experiences of friendship, and friendship is an experience of radical equality. And it leads to freedom as power. It liberates the capacities. It liberates a tendency. It liberates our passions. And the question is, are we going to commit to the transformations that our loves and our friendships imply, that they point towards? Are we going to commit to the transformational events that we can feel beginning to happen at special places and times? If we commit in that way to our being a part of something bigger than us, but still situational and local, well, we're engaging in something that they would call communism. And then maybe lastly, they suggest that what we need to do as communists is to communalize the ability to see. We need to overcome the isolation of individuals, which they think a state socialist society will not facilitate. This is an anti-authoritarian tendency. We got to stop just being individuals and see our interconnections. And we have to stop being numb. We're super numb. This world is really hard. We're like barraged by all kinds of stimuli, and we're afraid of all kinds of things, especially the police. And so we numb ourselves, and we just watch Netflix and drink beer or eat ice cream, you know? We got to start feeling again, start feeling one another again, start feeling the real situations that we are in again. And this practice, this way of living, of being really here and now, really tuned into the situation, but with a defiance, with an insistence upon our ultimate freedom and equality. And when we practice in this way and do the actions that our perceptions point out to us as desirable, then we're communists. We're engaging in communism, the sharing of experiences, the sharing of transformation, the sharing of the transformation of ourselves. And this is something beyond just the establishment of institutions or large-scale organized fights with a leadership that is going to tell us what's the right thing to do. This is a totally different way of living. And communism, they say, is a general detotalization. We want to break down the large-scale structures which organize us, and we want to tune into where we are right now, tune into those with whom we are right now, and generate a perpetual intelligence of the situation. And this requires something that we might also call democracy. We have to constantly be talking to one another. We have to have an ongoing commitment to really try to understand what's up, to speak generously with one another. And not just to speak about anything, but to speak about the situation, about what is really here right now. If we develop that practice of thinking the situation, then I would suggest We are doing democracy, and we are establishing community. We are realizing community, and we are living and affirming our equality, and we are liberating our freedom.